The following is a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio.
Welcome back to another award-winning Kiefer and Curry show right here on TKR. Of course, you can hear this show. It's on every single day at 11:30 Central Time in the morning, Monday through Friday, wherever you get your podcast, available through any industry you have your podcast. I don't care where you listen to your podcast, you can find the Kiefer and Curry show. We're on everything. And coming soon, starting next week, we'll be on the Tony Curry YouTube channel. So make sure you check that out. You can actually see Kip and myself talking about what's important to us. And that's what this show is all about. And you know, Kip, first of all,
They'll be able to see me?
Yes, they'll be able to see that lovely mug of yours.
Man. Yeah,
so it's going to be a different dynamic for the big show coming up here in the next weeks or two. So make sure you check us out on our YouTube channel on Tony Curry Radio. So a couple of weeks ago, James William Buffett passed away. It was a surprise to most of us right over Labor Day. Of course, the Pascagoula native was born and raised pretty much out of Mobile, Alabama, so he's one of our own. I didn't realize this. He had sold over 20 million albums. Not a big surprise. Did you realize that when he died, he was a billionaire?
I did not realize that. I know that the Margaritaville franchises are springing up all around the country. And that is a phenomenally successful situation. And I'm sure Jimmy banked quite a bit in the latter part of his life by having his name and association with that, because this is a booming entertainment enterprise.
It is indeed. A man who commanded $1.5 million per show. And so he could play as many shows as he wanted. He was an automatic sellout wherever he went. If Jimmy Buffett played your town, you knew it was going to be a sellout. And on top of that, he was an accomplished author. He wrote over 20 different books. He wrote children's books. And of course, he was also involved in some liquor encounters as well. So the guy was pretty much all over the place.
And A billionaire beach bum. Is that not the dream, Tony?
Well, that is the dream. And, you know, it's funny because I'm wondering now that he's gone if, in fact, he'll be worth more dead than he was alive, like we see so many of our songwriters and our rock and roll stars. But based on that, and I've heard you on this show, and not to mention Need to Know, which you can also hear right here on Tony Curry Radio at 1 p.m. every Monday through Friday. You are a master at reciting lyrics. I'm not very good at it. But you can remember lyrics from songs, and I know that you have a soft place in your heart for the likes of Jackson Browne, who you saw recently, Harry Chapin. I know you're a Dan Fogelberg fan. So I thought it'd be kind of fun to talk about some of our best and most loved singer-songwriters and what it would be like to lose some of these folks. And by the way, before we get started, I wanted to go through Rolling Stone's top 100 singer-songwriters. I'm not going through the 100, but I will give you the top 10, which I think is very interesting. Number 10, Stevie Wonder. Number 9, Joni Mitchell. Number 8, Paul Simon. Number 7, Carole King. Mick and Keith, the Rolling Stones, are in there. Smokey Robinson was number 5. Chuck Berry was the fourth best songwriter of our time, which I think is really interesting. And then John Lennon was number 3, Paul McCartney number 2. You can certainly put them together. And Bob Dylan was voted as the number 1 singer-songwriter of all time, according to Rolling Stone magazine. I just thought that was really interesting. Wanted to get that out of the way before we get started on our show this morning. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think if you go back and really, and if we're talking really here about and I guess you being the expert on this and me just being kind of the fan and avid consumer of everything lyrical, is songwriting is considered in the biz more the lyrics or the combination of the music with the lyrics?
It's a great point, because I think in a perfect song, you get both. And we'll certainly be talking about that. And just what I mentioned there, Jimmy Buffett, Jackson Browne, James Taylor, some of the great singer-songwriters, they do tell stories. And we love those stories. Cats in the Cradle is an all-time favorite song of mine because it tells a story. And it's a story I never get tired of hearing. And Lying Eyes from the Eagles is another one of the songs where I hear that. And it just bums me out whenever they play the edited version because they cut out totally the second verse. And it's a story. It's like taking it's like taking 4 chapters out of a book. I don't care if it's 6 minutes long or not. Don't give me the 3-minute version. Or American Pie, another one of those songs where I know
how they cut it down. And takes away all the effectiveness of the song, in my opinion.
Well, sure it does. When it was first released, they were like, this is a 70 song. We can't have a 7 minute 70 songs. Well, you know, the Beatles did it with Hey Jude. Why can't you? And there really wasn't a particularly story told in that particular song. The Beatles didn't tell a lot of stories in their songs, but lyrically, melodically, they were just wonderful songs. That's why John Lennon and Paul McCartney are probably number two and number three. But I'd love to hear, give me one of your favorite songwriters, and if you can, share a story about it, and then I'll give you one of mine.
Well, I have a thought on what you just said. There's a song by Billy Joel, who is an outstanding songwriter, and I'm actually kind of surprised he didn't make the top 10 list. But he has a song that a lot of people probably aren't familiar with called The Entertainer. Yes. And he's lamenting a lot of things about the music industry in that song. And he says, there's a passage from what you just, to highlight what you just said. It was a beautiful song, but it ran too long. If you want to have a hit, you got to make it fit. So they cut it down to 305.
Yes, that's what I'm talking about.
So, I mean, there's so many examples. I guess that's probably not as big a thing now, because back in the era where a lot of hit music was played, and I have no idea, Tony, I really don't like the direction. And of course, I sound like an old guy, you know, get off my lawn kind of thing. But, you know, the songs now with the same basic beat, I think there's only three or four different kinds that pretty much are in every single song. Lyrics are, to me, and tell me if you disagree with this, in this era, it seems like lyrics have been de-emphasized. It's just repetitive things said basically over and over again. And I think that's really sad, because a great song, yes, the music is a huge key to that. But also, to me, the beauty of music is it's modern day poetry set to a great accompaniment. And I just don't see that in modern day music. And I think it's really sad.
I think you're totally right. I don't think we have time to hear stories anymore, for the same reason why we don't read books anymore. By the way, Billy Joel is number 50 on the top 100 really? Songwriters of all time. Yeah, which is kind of surprising. He wasn't much higher than that. But I totally agree with you. And I do think it's a stodgy way of listening to music when you have great stories. But Taylor Swift, who's 99th on this list and obviously moved up, she is one of these gals that not only writes a great melodic song that's easy to listen to, and you could talk about Wormholes and everything else that people just want to hear her songs over and over again. She's a great songwriter. She does a wonderful job of telling stories. And that is one of the reasons that so many people absolutely love her music, because she does tell stories in her stuff. A band that I thought just did just a wonderful job, and I really wasn't into them when they first got out. They met at Bard College up in Hudson, New York, back in the mid 60s. Walter Becker and Donald Fagen of the band Steely Dan. And thank goodness they had only studio players. And there was Skunk Baxter from the Doobie Brothers used to play with them. They had Paul Schaefer that actually orchestrated a lot of their arrangements. They did a wonderful job. They just did not tour at all. They were not a touring band until later in life. And unfortunately, Walter Becker was taken away from us about 6 years ago. It was 6 years ago last week, as a matter of fact. And I thought for sure that when Walter passed away, that Steely Dan would wrap it up and not do shows anymore. And they're doing more shows now than they ever have. Donald Fagen just keeps rolling. As long as you got the lead singer and it sounds like Steely Dan, I guess it works. But one of those bands where, you know, I can remember lyrics and songs. Is There Gas in the Car from Kid Charlemagne, the FM soundtrack, Dirty Work, Sending the Maid Home Early. I just remember some of the great songs, and I really wasn't into their sophisticated, smart-ass, lyrical type of compositions probably until I got out of high school, and then I realized just how good this band was. And something I realized was there's a song called Time Out of Mind, which is about chasing the dragon, which is the DOC, the drug of choice. And, and if you go to enough concerts, and you may have actually heard this at Jackson Browne, there's a lot of bands that play Time Out of Mind right before the band hits the stage, because it is compositionally the perfect song to do sound checks to. Bonnie Raitt uses that song. James How Taylor uses that song. AC/DC uses that song. So it doesn't just have to be singer-songwriters, but they use, because the composition with the drums and the keyboards and the saxophone and the guitars, it is just a perfect song to do sound checks to. If that song sounds good on your soundboard, you're good to go. You're ready to hit the stage. But I just love their music. I just think they're unbelievable. And just the fact that you know, we've gotten a chance to listen to Steely Dan as long as we possibly have. They're probably bigger now than they ever were back in the 70s. You can go through the Do It Agains and the Reel in the Years and all their songs. I just think they're some of the best songwriters that I'd ever had. And how they did it was really interesting, too, because Walter would come to the table with the story, or as you say it, the poem. And Donald would take it and then sophisticatedly enough would try to arrange the music in and around. And if you really sit back and listen to, say, like the album Asia, which is a great song in and of itself.
Oh, yeah.
And just listen to the entire album, which is one of their later releases, and just listen to it in super stereophonic sound in both your earphones. You won't be able to take your earphones off. You will not be able to take your earphones off. Even if you're not a Steely Dan fan, you cannot get past the fact that sophisticatedly enough and symphonically enough, it was just superior to anything on the radio. It was amazing. It really was.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned the 70s when Steely Dan rose to prominence and so many others. You know, to me, that was the golden era.
Yes.
Because again, my love of music is relatability of the artists and the songs. I have a creative streak. You know, I love to write. I write a lot of my own poetry. I don't share very much of it because every time I do, somebody thinks I'm referring to them.
Oh, no, when you do, by the way, on Facebook, check out Kip Kiefer on Facebook. Your poetry is unbelievable. And a lot of people will comment on it thinking that you've ripped it off from someone else. That is your handwritten stuff, man. It's excellent.
Yeah.
It's really, really good. Really good.
So when I come across artists that really speak to me, it's just incredible. You mentioned Jackson Browne, who has, in my opinion, just an unbelievable catalog of music. But the two, and this is just kind of one of those things that you talk about relatability and your attraction and commonality that you hear in so many songs and lyrics. But Jackson Browne, in my opinion, has two absolutely unbelievably great albums. And both of them were based on times in his life where he had suffered the loss of someone that he dearly loved. Mm-hmm. And I'm not talking about necessarily, and one of them was his first wife. She actually committed suicide. And he was in such a bad place and grieving. And he wrote the classic album, Late for the Sky.
Yes.
And a lot of those songs were, you know, basically recounting exactly how he was feeling about that situation. And probably his masterpiece late in his career, just 15 or so years ago, he had a long relationship with the actress Daryl Hannah. And they had all kinds of plans and they had thrown in completely together. Well, then she became obsessed with John F. Kennedy Jr., mm-hmm. Who was about to marry the woman who would become his wife and tragically would perish with him in the plane crash. But Daryl Hannah, apparently pretty much out of nowhere, started accusing Jackson Browne of being physically abusive, which really doesn't fit his profile. And nobody never been very any evidence of that. And just abruptly ended the relationship. And Jackson Browne responded with the album about 6 months later, I'm Alive.
Yep.
And the songs on I'm Alive, Tony, if you've ever had the heartbreak of romantic breakup and you know, the turbulence that automatically comes from that, I know, like me, you've been through a divorce. It's just something so emotionally ringing and gut wrenching, and to hear someone else in a position to kind of relate those feelings that you're having in music, it's been unbelievably therapeutic for me. And so I know every word to every one of those songs. I'll give you a quick passage. One of the best Jackson Browne songs on the I'm Alive album is called Sky Blue and Black. Mm-hmm. And the song is just unbelievable and probably has my favorite verse ever in music. Talk about relatability. And he says, you're the color of the sky reflected in each storefront window pane. You're the whispering and the sighing of my tires in the rain. You're the hidden cost and the thing that's lost in everything I do. Yeah, I'll never stop looking for you. through the sunlight and the shadows and the faces on the avenue. Beautiful. How powerful is that?
It's absolutely beautiful. I have told you the story, I think, on this show.
Yes.
Where I actually brought Jackson Brown on stage. It was about a month and a half after his messy departure from Daryl Hannah. And of course, his concert promoter came up to me and said, do not ask him anything about Daryl Hannah. We spoke about Daryl Hannah for 45 minutes.
That's incredible.
Backstage. I never brought it up. And I had a Memorex tape. That's when we had tape recorders. It was back in the late 80s. And I flipped that tape over three different times. We talked for almost an hour and a half. And he kept saying, when you flip the tape, are you not recording over what we've already talked about? I said, yes, we are. I said, but I don't know what else to do. I said, I know that I've got to get this on tape. I actually turned it into a rockumentary that ran on Rock Dinner 95 at the time. But he openly and finally his promoter came up. I started speaking with him at about 6:30 and it was 8 o'clock. It was showtime. They're like, Jackson, we got to go. And I think I could have talked to him for the entire night. You want to talk about I'm Alive? It's no better than the first track off that album called The Problem. My Problem Is You. That is just a fantastic song. And then it goes into, you know, a little bit more of a lighthearted Too Many Angels. That album is just fantastic. While it didn't have any hits on it per se, and also the song Two of Me, Two of You, which is one of my favorite songs of that album, was just fantastic. Yeah, no doubt. There's another guy that I want to give some preference to, because when I talked about to you before we did the song about our best songwriters, I was thinking more lyrically. I was thinking poetry. I was thinking songs that were written about stories. Now, there are some prolific songwriters. Well, Paul McCartney and John Lennon may be the greatest songwriters of all time because they did do the melodic part of it. You can't really say there was a lot of depth to a lot of their music. And certainly to go with Jackson Brown, you know, you got something special when you know your favorite artist has gone through tragedy because you know some of their best material is on the way. And it's unfortunate it works that way, but some of the best artists, including Eric Clapton, wrote his best stuff when he was going through his darkest times.
Oh, yeah.
But there was a guy out there that I'd be remiss not to bring up. He wrote 73 top 40 songs. He wrote 7 number ones. He had over 1,100 different artists record some of his 500 songs, but Burt Freeman Bacharach, I think, has got to be on this list.
Mm-hmm.
He just left us back in February of this year. And you're going, Burt Bacharach. I can promise you right now that if you turn the radio on somewhere, whether it's on Tony Curry Radio, whether it's on NPR, or whether it's Magic 96 or whatever you're listening to, you will hear a Burt Bacharach song today. That's how much he infiltrated our musical tendencies. Unbelievable. The fact that he wrote songs for over 55 years, his first song back in 1957, wrote all the way to 2012. What's amazing about Burt Bacharach is he wrote all these songs for all these artists, and he only charted one time in his life solo.
Unbelievable.
He had a lot of solo albums, but most of them were instrumental. He had a song called Trains and Boats and Planes. Sounds like Trains, Planes, and Automobiles. And it was the only song that he ever charted a single off of. I think it went to like number 37 on the top 40. Isn't that amazing that he wrote all these songs? He was one of the few guys, much like a Michael Jackson, where you could say, write me a hit, and he could write you a hit. I'm not talking about, hey, I've got one I've been holding on to. I'm talking about write me a hit right now. He could write a hit. He wrote for everyone from Celine Dion to Dionne Warwick to Dion. He wrote for, and the fact that he wrote so many hit songs, Kip, for artists back in the 50s all the way through the 2000s, because music's changed a lot.
Oh, God.
What does that tell you, that he could write a 2-minute ditty in the 50 and then write, you know, an 8-minute song in 2012? He's just an absolutely amazing guy. And I love the fact he always put his artist first. He did win 6 Grammys. He won 3 Oscar awards. He won an Emmy award as well. But the fact that he could write that many songs and was always happy enough to take a backseat, as big of a backseat Burt Bacharach would ever have, was just amazing to me, and just speaks volumes about how much he loved the industry of music.
I mean, he was the backbone of so many people's career.
Yeah.
Just what he could create. I'm thinking,
Dionne Warwick, I'm not sure if Dionne Warwick would even exist without Burt Bacharach. I'm being serious.
No chance. Yeah. No chance. She would have been only known for the Psychic Friends Network. that was a great pivot for Dionne, by the way. Yeah. I think when he passed away, you know, you had a sense with a couple of days of tributes. And, you know, you think about and hear songs that he penned that they're just iconic. You know, I'm thinking about, you see this guy's in love with you. I mean, it's just simple lyrics. They're not real deep, but they are very poignant and very heart tugging. And there's just so many examples of Burt Bacharach's contribution. And that's amazing on his own creations and his own releases. Only one top hit. That's, and it only got to number 37. That's just astounding to me.
That's amazing. He's another one of your favorite singer-songwriters. I'd love to hear it.
Well, you know, you mentioned Harry Chapin, who I actually devoted a whole need to know about Harry at one point when I decided that I needed to get off my political soapbox for a week and go a different direction, because every time I have an opportunity, because we kind of discovered Harry by mistake when I was in high school. And this was a guy that toured endlessly. I think at the height of his career, just a couple of years before his death, I think it was estimated that he was on stage 320 out of 365 days in one calendar year.
Crazy.
I mean, that's absurd. And he had gotten to the point where he had so many causes and he was so socially involved. Several people in Washington said he was the most effective activist outsider in Washington in history. Because he didn't just ask for your participation. He wanted a commitment.
Yeah.
Bruce Springsteen said in his memorial service that, you know, with all the love in my heart, I'm going to say Perry was a giant pain in the ass. He said, because he would not back down. If he wanted you committed to something, he was relentless until you just gave in. And then you realized when you got in the middle of whatever he was promoting that you were proud to be a part of it. But it was just that kind of guy. But he was another guy who could just write these. And he probably is as known for the story song as just about anybody, because his songs were, you know, beautifully musically accompanied, because he had his brother on the piano, Steve Chapin, and he had Big John Wallace, who played guitar and always had cellists. The music is beautiful that accompanies these fantastic story songs. One of his early hits, and he always joked the same thing we just talked about. His songs were always too long. They didn't want story songs. But that's when you mentioned Cats in the Cradle. That was one that was the right length and really rocketed his career to another level. But one of the earliest songs that I absolutely fell in love with was a song called A Better Place to Be, where he's a story about a little security guard who comes into a diner, and a woman in that song that's described as a big old friendly girl is the waitress. And he tells his story to her, and if you get a chance to listen to it, it is absolutely fabulous. And there are so many others. My all-time favorite is a song called "There Only Was One Choice," which was written in the bicentennial year of 1976. And if you listen to it today, I mean, that was 50 years ago coming up on, and the song is still so spot on to what we're experiencing today. I mean, this was a guy that was ahead of his time, could see a lot of things that were coming up. And in his lyrics and in his songs, he was just an absolute master.
I love that. That's fantastic. My last songwriter was a person that had just a huge influence on my life. And I'll go back to my good Catholic boy days. I used to be an altar boy, almost became a priest, believe it or not, when I was 18 years old. And one of those reasons I was in the
Father Curry.
Yes, I almost had the collar on, my friend. That would have been a different world we lived in. I would have changed some lives if I was Father Curry. I don't know if I would have made it that long, but I discovered girls when I was 18 too. So the Lord did not speak to me loudly enough. One of the artists, we used to have these things called Search Weekends. And while everyone else was going to AC/DC and Iron Maiden concerts and stuff, I was going down to St. Joseph's down in downtown Cincinnati and was doing wagon wheels and holding hands with other individuals and talking about the good book and the good word. And one of the songs that was our main song for the weekend, if you will, was Shower the People. From James Taylor. Yeah. And I fell in love with that song. And everyone kept saying, man, if you like this song, you need to go get his greatest hits album. And I was one of those guys. Yes, I'll admit, before I was a James Taylor fan, I actually used to listen just to his greatest hits. That's okay. If you want to go find the biggest, best stuff from an artist first before you fall in love with their entire catalog, please do that. But a guy that actually got nominated for a Grammy in 1970 and then didn't play actually the Grammys till 33 years later in 2003 when he finally graced the 45th annual Grammy Award winners. It's a guy who actually hung up music in 1985 and retired. Just think about how the world would be different if somehow 38 years ago, James Taylor never played a live concert. He just played at Oak Mountain Amphitheater at the age of 75, just several weeks ago. I get a chance to go see him because I figured it would probably be the last time to see James play. And despite the fact that he sings and sounds like a 75-year-old, he did everything he could to muster every single note he could hit. It was just one of the most amazing shows, much like you talk about Jackson Browne. I'm not sure how Jackson Browne is, but I mean, when you
74,
yeah, when you love somebody that much, they can't go wrong. But he laid it out on the floor, and there was a thunderstorm that was coming, and I got goosebumps. I talk about this. There was a thunderstorm warning that was over the Pelham area, and he was supposed to do an encore, and he went back and said, I'm sorry, we're gonna have to end the show because there's a thunderstorm, and the crowd wouldn't let him leave. They would not let him leave. And he's like, well, I'm supposed to do three encores. I'll do two. And he played two encores, much to the delight of the thing. He was 69th, by the way, on the list of Rolling Stone's great songwriters. If you're in the top 100, I think that just goes to show just how wonderful you are. But Danny Kortchmar, who is a guitar player and has played with James Taylor all the way since the 70s, said it best about James. He said, every single one of his songs sounds like a Christmas song that was written 100 years ago. And I just think that's such a beautiful way to remember James Taylor and his music while he's still here and when he goes. But every song he ever wrote sounds like a Christmas song that was written 100 years ago. It's just so warm. It's inviting. It may not be so eclectically different than something else that you're looking for, but it is something that just it's feel good music. There is tragedy in it. He's singing songs about his pet pig. He certainly sang a lot of tragedy in his one of his first songs in Fire and Rain. But yeah, you want a little joy in your heart and you just want to mellow out a little bit. James Taylor is the one you need to put up on 11 for sure.
Yeah, my favorite James Taylor song is well known, but kind of obscure compared to what would be considered his traditional hits. I love the song Sweet Baby James. Oh, it's just a beautiful accompaniment to some fantastic lyrics. And every time it comes on, it's just a feel good song for me.
Yep. Got your baby, got your blanket, got your bucket of beer. That's why I'm here. That's one of those great song.
There you go.
James Taylor as well. Do you have anything else to add, sir?
I just on that same vein, I was in Las Vegas about, and I always get my years wrong. I said 15 or 20 years ago when I was talking about Jackson Browne and Daryl Hannah, and then you filled in that blank and said late 80s. So I started doing the math in my head and said, I do this all the time. I say just a few years ago, and it's been 10 or 12 years ago. So you always have to cut me a pass here on being off on dates. But I think this was about 5 years ago. I was in Las Vegas. My son, Clayt, who has now moved back to Birmingham, but he lived pretty much right behind the Strip, pretty much right behind the MGM Grand Hotel on the next street over. So it was literally a two-block walk to the Vegas Strip from his house. And at the MGM Grand Theater, I just happened to see when I arrived that on a Sunday night, Paul Simon was playing on his farewell tour.
Oh, man.
And I just like you, I said, I have to go to that. I have nobody to go with. My sons certainly weren't interested. They're from a different era and don't really appreciate the impact that Simon and Garfunkel, and particularly those knowledgeable, know that Art Garfunkel was certainly a part of that that whole thing, but Paul Simon was the franchise.
Yeah, he was.
Was the songwriter, and I went to that show, Tony, and the range of music. And this is another guy who really became a household name with the with the whole soundtrack of the movie The Graduate, which that movie to me too was so far ahead of its time, coming out in 1967. But basically, it was constructed around the release of the Simon and Garfunkel album and the entire soundtrack, of course, which songs like Mrs. Robinson and another song, a lot of other songs in that as well, were the soundtrack. And to see Paul Simon and see the range of music and how he evolved over the years, he got interested in all kinds of other cultures and started playing with a lot of great musicians from all over the world, from the Middle East, from Africa. The variety of people he brought on that stage and the music he presented, I mean, it was just virtuoso stuff. And I'm so proud and privileged to have seen that show, because that was one of those things you're pinching yourself the whole time, you know, thinking that how great this is. But I will mention real quick, because we're talking about lyrics, and you had cited my ability to recall them. Mm-hmm. There's a song in The Graduate that is underappreciated. It's called April Come She Will, and it's very short, so I'll recite it for you real quick here. Once again, about love and despair. April, come she will. When streams are ripe and swelled with rain, May, she will stay, resting in my arms again. June, she'll change her tune. In restless walks, she'll prowl the night. July, she will fly and give no warning to her flight. August, die she must. The autumn winds blow chilly and cold. September, I'll remember. A love once new has now grown old.
That's beautiful. That's absolutely great. And any guy that could put Chevy Chase in one of his videos is going to be a fan of mine for sure. Paul Simon, there's no doubt. And the other thing is amazing about Paul Simon is you could certainly make the argument that when they parted, and I'm talking about Art and Paul, you could have never fathomed Paul Simon's career being bigger on the other side than it was with. I mean, you're talking about them playing, you know, Central Park in front of 300,000 people. They were as
big, that was insane.
They were as big as music gets, and Paul Simon has certainly got bigger than that. Hey, great show, my friend. Let's do it again next week. The Kiefer and Curry Show. We do it every single day right here on TKR, 11:30 a.m. Central Time. You can hear this show every single week and, of course, wherever you get your favorite podcast. And don't forget, coming up on Saturday morning, every Saturday morning on ABC 3340, it is the Starting Lineup with Kiefer and Curry. We're going to be talking about college football. We had a Bama loss this past week. We had an Auburn win. UAB goes down as well. We'll see if we can gather ourselves and get it back on the winning track here for our local teams. We'll be giving you some plays. Case Kiefer is going to be on there. Terry Quillian will be giving you a rant of the week. And, of course, we have the legend doing his Tide forecast. He should be a little cranky coming up for our next show coming up on ABC 3340. 10:30 to 11 Central Time right here in Birmingham, Alabama for the Kiefer and Curry Show.
This has been a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio.